Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to ITE 2, Module 3. Hope you all had a wonderful week. I'm back for another instalment. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about the fundamentals of the network and the design of the network. We're going to be talking about topologies a little bit more, the physical and logical topologies, and how you connect up all of the devices on the network when you're setting it up. So it's like an A to Z of setting up your network today. Okay, first thing I wanted to talk about was the network interface card, or the NIC as we abbreviate it down to. So can anyone tell me what a network interface card is designed to do?
Hopefully it's designed to provide a way of connecting your computer to the network, to the local network.
Yeah, it's a pretty good way to put it, yeah. So it plugs into your system board and provides you with all of the ports that are necessary for connecting all your media on your network. That was a good answer. It's the component of the computer that actually interfaces with your local area network. And when you have your network interface card installed in your computer, the IRQ and the IO address, memory space for your operating system, and the drivers get set automatically so that they can do what they need to do to get everything moving along hunky-dory. Yeah. So when you're actually setting or selecting your network interface card to use on your network, you need to think about the type of network that you're setting it up with. So the cards are designed for your Ethernet local area networks, token ring, FDDI, which is, anyone want to tell me what FDDI stands for? I know we haven't got many people, so don't want to seem to be picking on a small group, but...
I can tell you, it's...
Okay, Kerry, you can tell me.
Fibre Distributed Data Interface.
Yeah, that's the one. Well done, you get a cyber lollipop. Actually, you could get a real one, couldn't you?
I could, but I think I'd be right.
Oh, good. also the other thing you need to consider is the type of media. So, in other words, the type of connectors that you need, what type of ports, and what type of cabling you're going to be used, and all that type of thing. Also, the type of system bus, which is another consideration. For example, the protocol control information or PCI slots, all those things that you need to get at ISA, and with ISA we recommend that PCI be used with your FDDI cards. Okay, the next consideration you'd have to think about is setting up your IP address. And can anyone tell me how many bits are in a IP address?
IPv4 address.
32.
That's the one. Well done. So that's it. Good, thank you. And it's divided into four groups of 8 bits. Anyone want to tell me what we call the 8 bits or those four groups?
Can you tell us what those 8 bits are called, Moses? You type it into chat? Okay, possibly not. Okay.
Possibly not.
Okay.
Octet, that's the one. Yes, Jackie. They're 8 bits called octets, and they're represented by a decimal number, and we have them in the range of 0 to 255. And each of those octets are separated by a decimal point. So I guess most of us have, by this stage, all have seen an IP address and how it's set up. You might have 192.168.0.101 or whatever, but they're divided into octets. So each device that you have on the network will have its own IP address, and we refer to those as a host address or a node on the network. Also, we have a secondary dotted decimal number that we need to set up on the network, which is known as the subnet mask, and it always accompanies your IP address. And the subnet mask is just a tool that's used by the system administrator to allow them to segment the network address. So we refer to that as subnetting.
Now, just one point I want to make very briefly here. The subnet mask is only relevant on the machine that you set it on. So it is actually possible to set your subnet mask wrong and not to be able to talk to whole bits of your network. So the subnet mask is only relevant to the machine that it is actually configured on. So keep that in mind and make sure all of your machines have the same subnet mask, because it's actually the machine itself that uses the subnet mask to figure out whether addresses are on the local network or not. And I'm not sure whether that's covered later in these notes, so I won't elaborate at this time.
Okay, so an example of a subnet mask would be, for example, 255.255.0.0, and we'll be talking a lot more about different classes as we go along too, and that will all become clear. It's also used to determine whether a particular host IP address is local, as Kerry mentioned, on the same network segment, or whether that a host is remote. In other words, when we're talking about remote, we're talking about on another segment of the network. Okay, so when you're actually assigning an IP address for the hosts on your local area network, things you need to think about are whether you want to have a static address. Static is actually one that you as the administrator of the network assign. So you statically assign that address, you actually sit there and type it in and set it up that way. You can have it assigned dynamically, and when we talk about dynamically, it's actually assigned by the DHCP server. Anyone tell me what DHCP stands for?
Dynamic Host Control Protocol, although I think those notes may say configuration.
Yeah, that's correct. And also you have an automatic setting that you can choose, which is for private IP addressing.
Ah, now this is in your test. This is in your ITE2 test.
It is too.
It is, yes. Mm. And this is called a PIPA, Automatic Private IP Address Allocation. And it allocates an address in the 169.254 range, a PIPA. And that's there's even a question in the final exam, so watch out for that one. Automatic private IP address allocation. It exists on both IPv4 and IPv6, and it actually works on IPv4 by taking the MAC address and hashing it, and actually generating a theoretically random IP address within the Class B network of 169.254. But if you want to know any more about it, look it up on Wikipedia or something, because that's about all we cover on it at this point.
But it's in your test. Okay. If you've got a number of computers on a network, actually sitting there and putting static addresses in is going to take you a long time. So you would be utilising DHCP, using the server to set it up that way. And the other consideration is that you need to keep in mind that each IP address is unique on your network for each host. And your IP address actually gets stored in the network settings, and it's commonly referred to as the logical address. And we'll be talking as we go along in this course more and more about TCP/IP addressing. Okay, if you're using Windows system, obviously the IP address is entered into the TCP/IP properties dialog box. And the configurations that get entered are the IP address, your subnet mask, the default gateway, and also you can have optional values in there as things like domain name, system server address, and also the Windows Internet Naming Service. Okay, we've talked a little bit about DHCP, but as I say, it's important to have an understanding that. So it allows you to automatically assign your IP address to the PCs that are running on your network. The server that's running it in that type of network we call the DHCP server. And that server will assign the IP addresses and all the TCP IP configuration information that you need to the computers that are configured as the DHCP clients. Bear with me a second, I've got a dog caught up on my headset. My ears are going. Okay, thank you, Peter. My headset was going across the room. Okay, so when the DHCP server receives a request from a host, it selects an IP address from the predefined addresses that are actually stored in its database. And once it's got that information, it then offers those values to the requesting device. If that device accepts the offer, the server then will lease the IP information to the device, and that's for a specified period of time. And it simplifies it. It's a nice, simple way of setting up the network using the DHCP server, because the actual server keeps track of all the IP addresses. And also, it reduces the likelihood of duplicating the IP addresses or having an invalid IP address put in if you've got somebody who's not quite sure what they're doing trying to manage that network. The option to get your IP address automatically, again, is in that TCP/IP properties dialog box. Okay, if you've got a large local area network, trying to remember all of the IP addresses of the host is going to be a problem. So we use the domain name system, or DNS, and that is used to actually translate the computer names to a corresponding IP address. So the DNS software runs on the computer and it acts as a network server, and it then makes the address translations. Every time you access the internet, the translation process comes into play, and we refer to that process of translating the names to an address as a name resolution. It's an easy one to remember, isn't it? So the server keeps a record that maps the host names and their corresponding IP address. Okay. No, I'm just scrolling down to see what we need to cover there. Okay. Anything you want to add there, Kerry?
It basically summarizes the hierarchy of the DNS, which I'll rip through very quickly. Basically, okay. There is a hierarchical system of DNS servers, so not every computer knows about every other computer on the network. So at the top of the hierarchy, or at the trailing dot hierarchy, we have the root name servers. Then up from the root name servers, we have the name servers for the top-level domains, such as com, org, net, also the country-level TLDs, such as AU, NZ, US, HK, etc. Then up from that you have things like the .com.au domain name servers. So it's basically a hierarchical system. So when you're looking for the name of www.qcat.org, you first ask the root name servers to give you the name server address of a .org name server. You then ask one of the .org name servers whether it knows the address of qcat.org, and you then ask one of the qcat.org name servers what is the address for www.qcat.org, and you cache all of this so that you don't have to go through the whole procedure every time you do it. So that's the hierarchical nature of the DNS in a nutshell.
Thank you, Kerry. Okay, we talked about the default gateway. Now I seem to remember this. Default gateway is the near side interface of the router. It's in your test. Okay, and when you've got a computer that's on one network segment that's trying to talk to another computer that's actually on a different segment, it sends the data that it wants to to put to that other segment through a default gateway. And the default gateway is on the near side interface of the router. It's in your test.
The default gateway is on the near side of the internet router, yes.
And it's the interface on the router to which your local computer network segment is attached. So in order for each of the computers on the network to recognize the default gateway, the near side corresponding inside router interface IP address has to be entered into the host TCP/IP properties dialog box. I don't know why that I remember that one being in the final, I think. So, aren't we good to you? Okay.
Well, the answer you want for that is yes. Yes, we are good to you.
Yes, we are good to you. Yes, yes, yes. Okay. So I mentioned we'd also be talking about network topologies. And when we're referring to that, we're referring to the actual layout of the network or the topology. Okay. And what it does is it shows how the devices on the network are actually interconnected. When we're talking about each of the devices, we're talking referring to nodes. Some of those or hosts include your computers, things like routers, printers, all those components. And the topology influences the way that the actual network operates. We have touched on these in earlier modules, some of the different types of topologies. We've got star, extended star, bus, ring, hybrid type topologies. What do I mean when I'm talking about hybrid? Anyone tell me? Oh, have we? Oh, Moses, I won't pick on you. we lost Jackie, did we?
Well, I told her she could sign out if she'd had enough, so she signed out.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Okay, so when we're talking about hybrid, we're talking about a mixture of topologies. So you might have a network that's composed of, two or three different topologies, and then becomes a hybrid topology. All right, now networks can have both a physical, physical and a logical topology. The physical refers to the layout of the devices that are on that and also the media. And the logical topology, when we're talking about that, refers to the paths that the signals travel from one point on the network to another point on the network.
Yeah, it seems like Dave Ardew here, but I think I remember talking about this in Discovery on Wednesday.
Yes, I think you did actually. Okay, so the two terminologies can be a bit confusing because logical, in this instance, has got nothing to do with the way the network appears to be functioning. So the physical and logical topologies of a network can be one and the same or the same. What I mean by that is in a network that's physically shaped as a linear bus, the data travels in a straight line from one computer to the next, and hence it's got the bus physical topology, and it also has a bus logical topology. You can also have a physical and logical topologies that are quite different. And an example is that is where you've got a physical topology in the shape of a star, where you've got cable segments connecting all computers to a central hub, and it can have a logical ring topology. And if you think about a ring, the data is travelling from one computer to the next, and that's because inside the hub you've got the wiring connections and the signal's actually travelling around in a circle from one port to the next, hence the name ring. So yeah, it's a little bit difficult at times to predict how your data's travelling in a network because, if you're just looking at the physical layout of the network. Okay, different types of topologies. We've just touched on a couple. The bus topology, and we often refer to that as a linear bus. And in that type of topology, you've got all devices connected by one single cable. So you've got a cable running along, and you've got the bus travelling along, it goes to one computer, then to the next, and to the next, in a straight line. Okay, the main cable segment, when you have a bus topology, must end with a terminator, and that terminator absorbs the signal when it reaches the end of the line.
So at the end of the line, it's a case of, I still have Vista leading network signal. I have to say that every year.
Yes, off you go. If you didn't have a terminator, you'd have the electrical signal at the end there, bouncing back at the end of the wire, and you'd have errors in your network. In a bus topology, you've got one packet travelling along, so one lot of data can be transmitted at a time. If you had more than one packet, obviously you'd have push, crash. Bus topology, all in one line, one packet at a time.
And that would be a collision, and we talk about collisions because the signaling method on an Ethernet segment,
that's usually my trick, Kerry.
An Ethernet segment is some carrier sense multiple access with collision detection, which I think comes up later in these notes. So there you go.
Okay, another type of topology, the star. And it's the most commonly used architecture in Ethernet local area networks. So think about a star here, like they give an example of a bicycle wheel. So you've got all these spokes that connect to a central point in the middle. And all of the cabling segments actually meet there. So each host on the network is connected to that central device. You've got cables coming out from that central device, so usually a switch, and the hosts are on the other end connected at the end of each cable. When you've got a star network that gets expanded, you can actually have more connections from your switch to the main networking device. So you could have what's called a extended star. You've got larger networks, oftentimes they're using that extended star topology. When you have this type of topology, the network devices that have filter your data packets, for example, things like your switches and routers, they reduce the traffic that's on the wires, so the packets are sent only to the wires of your destination host. On a ring topology, as it sounds, it's a circular topology, you've got the hosts that are connected in the form of a ring or a circle. So it has no beginning, it has no end, so it doesn't need to be terminated because it's got no end, and I do every year too. Well, I couldn't let you down, Kerry. Okay, so the data's transmitted in a circular fashion, and a frame called a token travels round the ring and stops at each of the nodes that are on that ring. Okay, if the node, for example, it arrives at a node and then it wants to transmit data on, it then forwards that data on to the next node around that ring. So you don't have any collisions because it's only going on in one way. There are a couple of types of rings you can have. You can have a single ring. So in a single ring, you'd have all your devices on the network on a single cable, and the data travelling in one direction only. With a dual ring, you can have two rings. So in that scenario, you would be allowed to send data in both directions, and that allows what we call or refer to as redundancy or fault tolerance. And what I mean by that is that in the event of a failure on one ring, then you'd have the data still being transmitted on another ring. Okay, so that's the jewellery.
And if you'd like more information on Token Ring, because you happen to be interested in that sort of thing, have a look in the Thursday Chats folder. In the 2007 folder, there's quite an extensive discussion of how Token Ring operates.
Okay, still talking on topologies, we can also have a mesh topology. When you have that, you've got all of your devices connected to each other, and it's widely used in wide area networks, and it allows the interconnection of local area networks. I guess the disadvantages of a mesh topology is that it's expensive and it can be difficult to set up. As I touched on earlier, is hybrid topology. So that's where you have... Yes, Moses?
Ma'am, when you are talking about extended topology, you said we use it usually in a huge setup end of things. So could you tell us like where we use other topologies?
Can you hear him, Kerry? Because I can't.
Likely to use other topologies.
Any chance you could get in and knock your microphone level up a bit, Moses? We're having trouble hearing you. You want...
Can't actually hear you.
Yeah, you're at about 30 dB down on everybody. You want examples of somewhere we use topologies or something? I'm not quite sure what examples you want.
Perhaps type it into chat if you could, Moses, your question. We'll wait. I really can't hear you.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Ah, that's better.
Yeah, that's
better.
Yes,
can hear you now. Yeah, much better. Okay, give us your question now.
I was asking ma'am, she was talking about, you said we use extended topology in a huge setup kind of thing. So I was asking, could you give examples like where we use other topologies like ring topology? I mean, I was asking about concrete examples as in like in what setup likely to be used those topologies.
Oh, okay. Yep. No problem. Sorry, we just couldn't hear you before. In where you've got some of the larger, wider area networks, for example, in the mesh topology, you might find them used by big agencies like government agencies, because the ones I mentioned was the mesh topology was expensive, but when you've got government, they don't too worried about the expense, but it works out a very good topology to use because there's a lot of fault tolerance in that type of network.
I was just going to mention Token Ring is often used when you need network reliability. So whilst you only might be looking at 16 megabits per second, you need a reliable network at high loading. So you often see Token Ring networks used in banks and in transaction processing systems because you need extremely reliable network transmission under load. And you tend to use bus topologies in legacy networks, in other words, networks that haven't been upgraded, or networks that require to run long distances with shielded cables such as coax.
And a lot of places too use hybrid topology where you've got one or more types of topologies. When you've got, say for example, you've got a university setting and you've got loads of different buildings, different schools within the university, they'll use a combination of topologies. Has that answered your question, Moses?
Yes, ma'am.
No problem. Okay. All right, now we're just going to talk about the way signals are sent via the different types of cabling. I know we've talked about the different types of cablings before, but we're just going to go into it again and touch on it as we go along. So, different types, no problem at all. No, we don't mind, we appreciate the questions. Okay, different types of cabling. We've got copper cabling, talking about coaxial, twisted pair type cabling. The nicer, faster one, fiber optics or glass cabling, and we've got wireless. Fiber optics, obviously, we'll be talking about expensive, but rather nice to be using. Okay, so there are two grades of cable for each type of media, and the if we go into these in a little bit of detail as we go along. So the first one we need to talk about is plenum, and when I'm referring to that, plenum refers to the space when you've got a false ceiling and the floor above it in a building. So you've got network cabling that's laid in this space, and we have plenum grade cable, which is commonly or normally referred to as plenum. It's got an outer jacket that's made of Teflon, and that complies with both fire and building codes. Another type is PVC, or non-plenum grade cable, and it's made with PVC or polyvinyl chloride. It's less expensive option, but it's not sort of one that meets all your fire codes. And the reason for that is if it does burn, it gives off a poisonous gas, so it can't be used everywhere.
That's in your module exam too.
Yeah, it is actually, yeah. Twisted pair cabling, and that's we talked, I think, last week about twisted pair cabling. It's used in the telephone communications and a lot of Ethernet networks. As it sounds, you've got a pair of wires that form a circuit that transmits the data, and the pairs are then twisted. Now, the reason they twist them is to prevent crosstalk along the cable, and that's the noise that you get that's generated through adjacent pairs. So you've got pairs of copper wires. They're actually encased in a colored-coated insulation fabric or plastic, and they're twisted together. And then within that, or so decoding that, you've got an insulation insulated outer jacket. Two types of twisted pair cabling. You've got shielded twisted pair, which is referred to STP, and you've got UTP or untwisted pair. With shielded twisted,
UTP is unshielded twisted pair.
Did I say
You said
untwisted?
untwisted.
Untwisted. Yeah, that's a tongue twister. That's a tongue twister. Okay, with STP or shielded twisted pair, the cable combines cancellation, and the twisting of the wires are shielded. So each of the wires gets wrapped in a like a metallic foil, and that shields the wires from noise. And the four wires, pairs of wires, are then wrapped in another metallic foil. So with STP, you've got reduction of the electrical noise, both within the cable, which that noise, as I mentioned, was called crosstalk, and you've also got it shielded from the outside of the cable, so it's termed as EMI and RFI protection there. And now with UTP or unshielded twisted pair, it's got two or four pairs of wires, and the it relies on the cancellation effect that's produced by the two twisted wire pairs. So you've got hopefully a limit of degradation of the signal that you might get otherwise from electromagnetic interference, or indeed RFI or radio frequency interference. And it's the UTP is the most commonly used cabling in Ethernet networks. And the reason for that is that STP, although STP gives you better protection from interference, it's a cost thing. So it's more expensive. The other thing with STP is in addition to the shielding that's required, which adds to the cost, it needs to be grounded at both ends. If it's not, you'd have the shielding acting as an antenna. It would actually pick up signals. Okay, the as I mentioned, most of the networks today are used UTP. When we get to the end of the cable, we have a connection, connection that goes into either our router or switch, and then another connection at the other end that goes into your computers on the network. And the connector that we have is that little plasticky connector, and it's got a little press down thing. What do you call that press down thing, Kerry?
Well, it's actually officially called a retaining lug, but I call it a tunker because that's sort of the sound.
A tunker, that's right. Yeah, that's why I wanted you to say it. Yeah, I like Kerry's definition of a tonka. And that connector that we refer to with the tonka is an RJ45 connector. Okay, remember that name because that's going to come up again and again.
That's the RJ45, not the tonka.
No, yeah, they're not the two. Okay, so that you that all of the wires terminate with the RJ45 connector. Okay, UTP comes in a number of categories, and we categorize them by the number of wires and also the number of twists within the wire. So with regard to category 3 is the wiring that's used for your telephone connections, and it's got 4 pairs of wires and a maximum data rate of 16 megabits per second. You also have categories 5 and 5E. And they're as commonly used in your Ethernet cables. With category 5 and 5E, you've got 4 pairs of wires, and you've got a maximum data rate of 100 megabits per second. With 5E, you've got more twists per foot than with category 5. The beauty of that is that the extra twists give you less interference from other sources outside the cable, and also from other wires within the cable. You also have category 6. It's similar to the category 5, except you've got a plastic divider that separates the pairs of wires, and it's good because it prevents crosstalk. There's also in category 6 you've got more twists within the cable. Okay, fibre optic is becoming more and more popular. As I said, the disadvantage is cost. And it's a cable that produces or conducts modulated light transmissions. So it manipulates the light as it travels, and also the way in which the data is transmitted. Okay, so it's got a core of strands of glass or plastic, and that's in place of the copper, and it carries the light pulses as signals. It doesn't carry electrical signals as other forms of networking media do, and what I mean there is instead of those type of signals, it transmits the data and converts the data into beams of light, hence the name fibre optic. It's faster, gives you better bandwidth and signal integrity, and as I said, its disadvantage is its cost, and it's also more difficult to work with. All right, the next type of transmission obviously is favourite of many is wireless networking. And as it sounds, you've got electromagnetic waves, such as radio frequency, you've got also laser, infrared, and satellite microwaves that carry signals from one computer to another without the need of cabling. It's a versatile way of setting up your network, and more and more commonly used in the home situation. And also, well, I shouldn't say just the home situation, you've got wireless networks throughout, say for example, universities, businesses, major corporations, so that people can just take their laptop into a meeting and then they can just connect to the wireless network and have access to the internet that way. Becoming more and more common, you can go into a lot of places, hotels these days set up wireless networks all over the place, and I guess the disadvantages there is you've got to be really, really certain of your security, because other people can get in and use your wireless network otherwise. Okay, to be able to utilize a wireless network, your computers or your devices in the network need to have the proper wireless cards installed. Two most common wireless technologies that are used for networking are infrared, I'll just talk about the two as we go along. Infrared technology is where you've got digital devices need to be inside of the transmitter. So in other words, you've got a limited distance that the signals can be transmitted. So, and also the things can actually get in the way of infrared signals, so fairly easily you can get obstruction. An example of an infrared signal would be your remote control in your home. You ever tried to change your television station and a person's in the way, you've got interference, so it can be interfered with.
I tend to find that dogs have a habit of lying in the way of your remote
control. I was going to use dogs, yeah, because you go to change your television station and the dog's in the way. So, yeah, good point. RF technology can be used, or radio, where you've got radio frequency. It can be restricted as well. It can be used on a number of different frequencies, though. Again, it's subject to interference and also either physical or radio interference there. All right. Anything else you want to add there, Kerry, while I have a quick drink?
They're also talking about with wireless networking, you've got to make sure it's secure, because if you're transmitting stuff into the atmosphere, other people can snoop on your signal. And
absolutely.
The sped spectrum also allows people to share a wireless channel, because it stops stops wireless signals from completely obscuring each other. And it also increases the security by using multiple frequencies to transmit the data across. So that's always handy.
Okay. We've touched on the different types of ways, cabling and the way data can be transmitted wirelessly. Also, you're going to need other things on your network, such as hubs, switches, repeaters and routers. And the differences, it's important that you know the differences of what they are. So if you're talking about, for example, I love repeaters, helps on my network. When we're talking about a repeater, you've got your original router set up. What the repeater does is it receives the signal and then it repeats it or regenerates it and then passes it on. The reason I said I love repeaters is because in my home network I have a repeater set up halfway through the house and it actually repeats the signal to the other end of the house. So off I go and I'm onto my wireless network, which is very nice. When we refer to hubs, they're actually referred to as multi-port repeaters. So the hub repeats that signal onto. So the difference between those two devices is the number of ports that each has. For example, my repeater's got two ports, and a hub's usually got sort of anywhere from 4 to 20 ports. So if you've got a hub there, most commonly used when you've got 10 base T Ethernet or 100 base T networks, but you can have them in other networks as well. When you've got a hub in a network, it changes the network topology from a linear bus to a star. So you've got, for example, the hubs, you've got the data arriving over cable to your hub port, and then it's repeated on to the other ports that are connected on the same Ethernet local area network. Hubs come in three basic types. You've got a passive hub. Passive hub is where you've got or where you have a physical connection point only. So it doesn't actually manipulate the traffic as it comes across the hub, and it doesn't boost the signal either. So it's passive, it doesn't do too much. All right, so what we mean by that. When you've got an active hub, it needs to be plugged into your electrical outlet because it actually needs the power to amplify the signals that are coming through it. It amplifies those signals before passing it out to the other ports. And you have an intelligent hub. Intelligent hub is very smart. So with an intelligent hubs, they act as an active hub, but they've also got a microprocessor in them, so they can sort of diagnose what's happening and what's happening as the signals are coming in. Disadvantage there is that they are more expensive to set up your intelligent hub. Okay, so all the devices that you have attached to your hub hear all of the traffic. Therefore, your hubs contain a single collision domain. Kerry and I both touched on collisions earlier, and what it is where you've got two end stations sending data over the network wire at the same time, and obviously they have a crash or a collision. Sometimes you'll hear hubs referred to as concentrators, and they're called that because they serve as a central connection point. Okay, so they concentrate. They also operate at the physical layer of the OSI model. Okay, touched on switches earlier and bridges. So we use them when we need to break up a local area network into easier or smaller, more manageable segments. So what they do is they actually decrease the amount of traffic on the local area network, and that can extend your area past where you would be able to get to with just a single local area network. So what happens there, the devices connect to the network segments, like including your bridges, switches, routers and gateways, and they operate as they sound, or as you would think, at the data layer pardon me, of the OSI model. Losing my voice here. So with a bridge, it makes a decision of whether to pass a signal onto the next segment on your network. So when it actually sees that signal or the frames on the network, it looks at their destination MAC address and compares it to the forwarding table that it's got. And then it makes a decision whether to filter or copy the frame onto the next or another segment. Okay, so if, for example, you've got a destination device and it's on the same segment as the frame, the bridge would block the frame from going on to the other segments. When we're talking about that blocking of the frame, we're referring to filtering that segment. If, for example, you've got a destination device that's on another segment or a different segment, the bridge would then forward that frame. It would decide, okay, I'm going to forward that frame onto the appropriate segment because it's not going to collide. Another scenario could be if you've got a destination address that's not known to the bridge, the bridge would then forward that frame to all the segments except one, and that would be the one from which it's received, and we would refer to that forwarding there as flooding. Okay, so bridges are used when you want to improve your network performance, and switches we refer to as multi-port bridges. Okay, now while you've got a typical bridge, it would normally have a couple of ports. The switch can have a number of multiple ports. For example, I think we've got a 6-port switch just sitting here, or an 8-port. You can get them with more than that as well, lots more. Okay, so if we think of the bridge having only 2 ports, switch having a lot more, obviously, a switch is a better option in many cases, and is more commonly used, you know, in many settings now. Switches actually reduce the number of collisions that are on your network, because you've got more. Have I? Am I? Okay. Just moved my microphone. Okay, so you're reducing the number of collision domains that are on your network. Although your switch can segment a network into a multiple collision domains, it can't actually segment it into separate broadcast domains. So broadcast domains occur when your network is segmented into multiple parts. Okay, the router, which we've all got sitting in our houses, makes decisions on how to send data from one segment to another. They work at the network layer of the OSI model. They're slower than bridges and switches, but they actually make smart decisions on how to route your packets along the network. They're also capable of segmenting your network and into a number of multiple collision domains and also broadcast domains. So when I'm talking about a broadcast domain, I'm talking about a logical area in your network where you can have any computer connected to the computer network and it can transmit data to another domain without having to go through a routing device. This is all very interesting and complex, but it is important to have an understanding of it. That brings us to the end of today's lesson, would you believe? Okay, so I guess the things to think about there, just to sort of quickly go over what we've talked about. I know there's been quite a lot of detail in that lesson, but thinking about your net choice, or when you're choosing the type of network, you have to think about considerations like what type of topology you're going to set up, what type of media you're going to use, whether you're going to use manual addressing or static addressing, or whether you want to set up DHCP as your server, and the type of routing devices you're going to use on your network. Now, I'm not going to do any quiz today because I think it's not fair with just one person on. So thank you, Moses, for being with us through all of this lesson today and bearing with us. And have you got any questions before we sign off from today's lesson? Doesn't look like it. So, all right, everyone, well, we will be back next week with... Okay, thanks, Moses. We'll be back next week with another thrilling installment of ITE2. I think from memory, just trying to think what we're talking about, it is more on networks and the growth of TCP/IP, I think, and also going more and more into the different layers of the OSI model and the TCP/IP. So it actually gets quite interesting talking about the different layers of the OSI network we go into in. And I know you've done, Moses, you're also in CCNA Discovery, so you've probably done quite a bit on them, but it's important that we go over them and get them in. And we bring in sort of the start of Linux, I think, a bit more in next week's module as well. All right, so without any further ado, I was trying to say, we'll sign off for now and have a good weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.